Accession number 1193, atrial 46.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 46. Where, when you'd reached this area there where you were forming up, Mr. Iston, what was the terrain like that you were finding yourselves in?
Well, we're in the Chet Maskeen. The Chet Maskeen is a salt flat, you might say, right more or less on the coast. Where I said before, where Jaberba had been pulled out of the coast, it was sort of in that region, and that was going to be the forming up place for the battalion before they went to the start line. It was planned that the 8th and 9th battalion would do an attack on the 20th of March, and the 50th Tank Regiment would follow them across once the REs had made the crossing. And it was planned that we'd go across at Kasiba West, which was where the anti-tank ditch and the wadi crossed. It meant that we just had one crossing rather than having to do two, sort of cross the anti-tank ditch and then cross the wadi. At this particular spot, we did one crossing and we were across into the slope, it sort of sloped down a short way, and then it went right up into the forts and the dugouts and the trenches, and a really horrible spot it was. And it was at the 8th and 9th were doing the attack that night, and then the tanks were to go across, and the 6th battalion were to go through and expand the bridgehead once it was across. When we got into the Chet, and we were trying to be there for 11:15, and we arrived on time. But the form...
It was 11:15 morning or night?
Night. You see, the 8th and 9th, they went in, I think, about 9 o'clock. And we were, because of the confined space, we weren't due to arrive with the transport. The battalion had gone on into the Chet, and they had been there some time, but the transport was due to be there at 11:15, and by which time we should more or less have gone straight across and backing the battalion up as it went across. But when we got down to the into the Chet, was just solid, absolutely packed with tanks, Scorpions. Scorpion is the flail flowing tank, carriers. Everybody was there, and they just told us to turn around and go back to where we'd come from, which meant going along this road that we'd just had shemozzle with the policeman. And they, so we went back and we came up and did the same thing all over again the following night, which was the 21st. And the 8th Battalion and the 9th, they had got across that night, but unfortunately with the water coming down, there were, every vehicle, more or less, had what's called a fascinon, which is a bundle of twigs. When these twigs, there were bundles of branches. These were supposed to be dropped into the wadi, and then the tanks would go out over the top of them. But with the amount of water coming down, these had quite a lot had got washed away. And even when we went back the following night, we still couldn't get across the wadi. And we laid in this Chet. We laid there all night, really. Maurice Kirby had a few attempts to get round. As the tide went out, he tried to get round the tank ditch and work his way up the tank ditch, but that didn't. What was impossible. He was commanding of S Company at that time, which was mainly the carriers and the anti-tank, the mortars, the carriers and the anti-tank. At this, up to early in the morning of the 22nd, only about two of the tanks had got across. Two of them were in the ditch, in the anti-tank ditch, with just the turrets showing. And in fact, the RDs were trying at that stage to use these as anchors for their fascines. And we did eventually get some carriers across, but they wouldn't let any wheeled vehicles attempt it. It was just impossible for any wheeled vehicle to get across. The amount of water coming down and just these flex. You see, every time you went on, you'd flexed. With a track lay, it was all right, because the track laid on it, and then you run over the track. But with a wheeled vehicle, it was just digging into the fascines and scattering the fascines all over. So it was the one that's taken the across.
What was your role to be? You had everything worked?
Well, I would have gone across with the carriers. In fact, I did go across with the carriers that we got across. Once across and in the open space, we were going down. It sloped down slightly from the anti-tank ditch and the wadi, and then away up the other side into the hills. Now this was really unbelievable. Once we got over the top, there was everything flying. There was machine guns, mortars, artillery, flares. It was really a most frightening thing altogether. And we did get some the carriers across, and we managed to get some ammunition across. And the MO got himself across, and he dug himself a first aid place into the side of the tank ditch, like an open-sided dugout, if you like, just dug into the side of the tank ditch. And he was doing some marvellous work in there, and then there were stretcher bearers were doing their best to carry wounded across the tank ditch and up the other side, which was the dangerous spot, because the east side of the tank ditch was in complete view. The west side, it sort of was sheltered, and it was on the wrong side from, you know, the enemy was on the west of that. So that side was pretty safe. But to get across the ditch and then up the east side, that was really under fire continually, even through the night on fixed lines, which I've explained some tapes ago. They had a terrible job getting across. And then we did get the ambulances up eventually, close to the east side of the tank ditch. And a lot of wounded were got back. And later on, we started putting stretchers on the backs of the carriers and getting them down to the first aid post, and then manhandled across and back to the ambulances. I suppose somewhere about 4 o'clock in the morning we did start getting a stream of ambulances coming through, and they were whipped back to the CCS, the casualty clearing station, which is where we'd come from, more or less, where the guns were.
How did you get over?
I went over on a carrier.
What are your memories of that journey? What happened afterwards?
Well, I was trying to explain it. It was just all hell let loose once we got out. Once we got across the ditch, getting across one, two, barrel. Once across, and the carrier is laid nose down, as you might say. So anybody in the back is looking over the top. And you can see all these things. I mean, trace is a really frightening thing. A trace in itself is not a damaging thing, but when you think that every time, every trace you see, there's 10 bullets before you see the next tracer, you know, the traces look as though they're coming fairly slow, but you've got to remember there's 10 bullets in between the two tracers. Which a lot of people don't do. They just see the tracer and think, oh, that's all right, I can dodge in between those, but you've got 10 bullets in between the tracer. And the anti-tank, their anti-tank guns were giving us a pretty warm time. And when they land on soft sand, it goes in deep and you get a splosh. It doesn't explode normally. An anti-tank shell, it's fairly solid. But it goes deep in and you get a squash of earth coming up. And then when the artillery, their explosives are coming, of course, it just splatters all over. So you try and get your head down in the carrier when that's coming on. But just as you went over the top and going down this slope, you can see everything, you see. It's all there. And it looks as though the top of the carrier is just waiting for them to come in. It's not a very pleasant feeling at all.
So you crossed the ditch and you said you went down on the enemy side.
You went down on the enemy side. And then the infantry, you see, they were already up.
How steep
up
was
the bank? It was a what you would call a rolling bank. It wasn't very steep. It was what we'd call rather like a wall at the bottom end of it anyway. It did get steeper further up. But the bottom of it, where we were trying to get to and where these forts were, it was more of a rolling bank, you would say. Not a steep one, but a rolling bank. And, of course, it had a good view from their side. It had a good view all the way around. And then, of course, there was the bastion way down the wadi, which was directing everything. They could see right down. And they kept dropping flares across, so the parachute flares. So the place was well lit up. And then there was the where the lads had got forward, the infantry boys had got forward, dropping hand grenades in. You're going to see the dugouts going up and such like. So there was plenty of light.
And what were you asking then?
I was there in case we had a breakdown on, and in fact we had one or two broke down. Carriers. That was really the reason for me going across.
Did you have to stop or shelter, or were you moving around?
Well, the thing was that they would drive me up as close as they could to the broken down carrier, and I would jump across and do what I could inside the carrier. See, inside the carrier, once it got off the slope, if it was facing up the bank, you had a fair protection. But going down this slope, it seemed as though you had no protection because the top of the it's open, you see. A carrier is open. It's not like a tank where they're boxed in. The carrier is open at the top.
Was this the usual theory that in a battle I would have thought that they would just left everything? But you went to and you were working it while all this battle was raging.
Yes, because you've got. The carriers were only things across. We had no vehicles across. And we relied on the carriers to get the ammunition across and to get the wounded back. That's all we could. It was either that or else you had stretcher bearers carrying wounded on stretchers for. By now we're probably well over a mile, close on 2,000 yards across from the anti-tank ditch into the forts. Was something like 2,000 miles. That's 2,000 yards. So we were quite aware, for carrying injured back.
Is there any picture in your mind of that night as you were doing your work or doing the things you were supposed to do?
The picture of my mind of that night really is the following morning we were told to evacuate about 5 o'clock, I think. Not that morning, but the next morning. We were there a day and a night, if I remember rightly. I think it was about 5 o'clock the following morning.
This would be the 24th of March.
We were told to go back to where we'd come from. Again. And on this bank where the second policeman had been as we came towards it, I had to stop because I had something broken down in front of me and I had to stop and get out. Oh, by this time, I'd lost my driver. I lost my truck and my driver. So I was. By this time, of course, I had my toolbox and just swapping it wherever I had to go. He said, little titchy stand where he told us, so we said, I'm not going with that bugger anymore, he's mad. I never saw him anymore. So, anyway, I was coming back with what transport we'd accumulated. It was a sad departing, actually, that came out of that. But I had to stop where this second policeman had been to attend a breakdown, and I happened to look back and to see those tanks that had got across burning, and you knew that a lot of the lads were still across there. I think there was something like 16 officers and 140 men or something were lost that night. I've got figures somewhere, but I just can't remember. And the carnage of going back. I did stop and think, now what the hell's all this been about? Because we had heard that the French had said nobody would get through the Maginot Line. This was one time it really did stop me, because I just looked back and I see it all. As I said, as we were going up there, you could see us. Well, now in the dark, I could see all the flames and the guns flying and all sorts. That is one I'll always remember, I think. But the funny thing is, I've said before, as you go into battle after battle after battle, they start to come. The memory goes off them because it's becoming then a regular occurrence. But this is one that I remember. I'll always remember Alice, the first one. I think I always remember going to Sicily. But yet there were so many things happened that I don't remember. Not as I would like to remember them. For instance, I'm almost certain that Maurice Kirby and I went round, right round the tank ditch and into the wadi, which was some 400 yards into enemy territory, you might say, to try and get the carriers down the wadi and then up the side, maybe, rather than the crossing that we're trying to get that the REs hadn't got the knack off. Now, we stop and think after these. I'm talking in hindsight at the moment. I've gone off the battle. Maybe we should go to the battle still, should we? No, I'm on to it now, so I might as well carry on. On hindsight, the real problem was we didn't get the tanks across. Mind, if we got the tanks across, how would they have fared against the new 55-tonner with a 75mm gun? It's about to work out. But if we got them across, so I don't know. We don't know if the divisional commander went. We know that Brigadier went shortly afterwards. But yet, after that one, we had a very successful battle at Wadi Akarit before they went. So did Monty know that we weren't going to get through that Marath? Because he'd already set his left hook away with the New Zealanders and the 10th Armoured round the route that the desert group had found. And they were already behind the Marath line before we pulled out. So did he know, and he looked for somebody to blame? I don't know. It's something that'll puzzle me for a long time, I think. I've got a feeling.
Did it change your attitude, obviously, again in hindsight, did it change your attitude and those of your friends when you realised that this had happened, that in effect it had been outflanked and yet you lost so many men attacking?
No, because we realised that if it had worked, it would have been a brilliant feat. And it did work to a certain extent. There was a fault, probably with the REs, I would think, that they didn't have methods of bridging this gap. I mean, we're talking of a war that had been on now for 4 years, and to come along with fascines to gap a 12-foot deep anti-tank ditch, something like 12-foot wide at the bottom, it doesn't really make sense, does it? I mean, what they did, how they finally did get across, was that the two tanks dropped inside. And then they started to build up on with the two tanks as anchors. If that had been done in the first place, with a couple of old tanks, and dropped in and then built up across it, or if they'd bulldozed, put a pipe in and bulldozed a way across, because that bulldozer's there because they made a road down to the Chet Messine, they call it Osborne Avenue or something, after the RE that built it. So that bulldozer's there.
Come back to the battle. Did you see, do you recall seeing anything which was outstanding in your memory at all?
Yes. Maurice Kirby did great work. He walked, as I've said, the battalion, the infantry, were about 2,000 yards across the three battalions, and I believe the guards had got across the at the bastion as well. But the three battalions were across, maybe 2,000 yards, and Kirby got across and walked up to talk to the CO to see how things were going. The CO said he wanted ammunition. And Kirby came back and he got his carriers together and he took ammunition across, right up to the CO. And at 8 o'clock in the evening, 2,000 hours, the MTO arrived with, I think it was 5 three-tonners, with a hot meal. And that got across. It was manhandled across. Now, this is another thing. Eric Short, the MTO, he had just joined us at, I believe it was Bear Gardine. Anyway, after Tripoli, in the Tripoli area, Eric Short joined us. And he was Westminster Rifles. He was a journalist. Why he was made MTO, I'll never know. But he made a damn good one. I did mention some time ago about Dickie Dennis, who was his father owned garages. He would never have made an MTO. But Eric Short, he was brilliant. And he came up with the quartermaster staff, and every man got a hot meal. In the dark, and across 2,000 yards of enemy territory, as you might say. But the men got a meal, and Maurice Kirby was responsible for getting that across. The MTO brought it up, very short, with the quartermaster staff. They brought it up to the east bank of the anti-tank ditch, and it was got across by Maurice Kirby and one or two more. And also Maurice Kirby did manage to get two anti-tank guns across. He towed them across with carriers. I don't think it did any good to the to the crossing, because the anti-tank digs in. I think they did quite a bit of destruction actually to the crossing itself. They did come back to take some more across, but they wouldn't let him. They told him it was all off. We were pulling out, and this was 5 o'clock in the morning, I think.
Do you recall any incidents with NCOs and the men, or any particular man?
No, not really. I think we were all so intense of what we were doing that we didn't have much chance, really. There was lots said afterwards, but the battalion was so depressed after that.
In what way was it depressed?
Well, we'd had so much loss. I mean, why were we put back a day before we even went? You know, we should have gone out through on the 20th, we'd go through on the 21st. Why didn't we get the tanks across? But again, to a soldier, that's gone. There might be an inquest. When I say an inquest, there might be some talk about it, but really speaking, the soldier doesn't like to dwell on those sorts of things. To be fair, we got out, and we had a night's sleep, and we had a GOC's inspection. And worse than that, they got me on it. I couldn't pull any strings at all. I was on the GOC's inspection, and I didn't think very much. I thought I'd lost my touch altogether.
Were any men awarded medals that you know of for Marath?
Yes. Sergeant Davis, the medical Audi sergeant, he was a man I mentioned many times in the band. He got an MM. Captain Wood, well, I keep forgetting which company it was, I think it was D Company. He got a bar to his MC. And the new RSM, McMahon, he got an MM. He had quite an eventful night, McMahon. He was taken prisoner by the Italians and escaped. He was taken prisoner by the Germans and escaped. He had quite an eventful night. It's quite a long story, actually. I can't repeat it without going into it deep. But it was a depleted... we'd lost... Dick Owen was a great friend of mine. He was headquarters company commander, and then he'd gone to C Company, I think it was. Anyway, he'd gone to one of the companies, and I'd spent quite a lot of time with Dick Owen, and I thought a lot about him. Eardley Wilmot, I wasn't too keen on, but... the funny thing was that a few days before Montgomery had been to see us, before Marath, and he told Eardley Wilmot that he would be field marshal before he finished. And he was killed three or four nights later. He was a great soldier, Eardley Wilmot. He was the adjutant on the... I think I mentioned it there. He was the adjutant on the boat as we were going out, and he got smashed up with a... in the boxing ring, and we're all clapping our hands off because he got knocked about. He was a great soldier. He was a little bit too serious, in a sense. But he was a really good soldier and a good Durham Light Infantryman. So they were great losses. And then we lost one or two of the new officers, which I hadn't even got to know. Yeah, it was a sad night, really, in a sense, when you lose so many in one night. And at that time, it didn't look as though it had been really successful. But, of course, when we find out later, we'd taken five German divisions, which could easily have been ranging around looking for the New Zealanders who were doing the left hook. So, really speaking, it was a successful... defeat, I would say. We were driven back across the Wadi, so you take that as a defeat. But the success was that we took on these five divisions, the German and Italian divisions, and it drew we used his reserves up, so that when the left hook came in, his reserves were already committed onto our line. So maybe that was what Monty wanted. He had two good options. I mean, he knew that there was a way around the Matmata Hills, and he knew he could get into the Alhama Plain and to Gabies, which was what he wanted. And I think that at the end of the day, I think he was probably satisfied, but I think he would have liked to have seen, for his own personal ego, he'd like to have seen the Marath line broken, properly broken, and gone through the way and all our men.
The morale of the battalion after the action?
Well, as I said, as usual, we got the GOC's inspection, no less than General Lees from, Sir Oliver Lees from 30 Corps, the Corps commander.
And you feel that this was intended to get your minds
off? Oh, yes. I mean, spit and polish, isn't it? And there's... See, it's another thing that you don't think so much about at the time. But the RSM, you see, he's prowling around, he's watching everything. That's not good enough, lad. That's how those shoes cleaned. I mean, everything was pressed, you know. Everything washed and pressed, and it was just like a big parade. And funny enough, later on, when we did the parade for General Nichols, after Amphetaville, Wadi Akrit, we dressed up in lines of companies. And think this is 4 days after a battle in the front line. And we're about 5 miles behind the line, and we're dressed up and we're doing a parade in lines of companies. That just gives an impression of what the air situation was after in North Africa. You know, after the way we didn't blink an eyelid unless we got shelled or bombed. And then suddenly we can form up in lines of companies 5 miles behind the line 4 days after we've been in the front line. It's unbelievable in a sense.